From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Last night, President Clinton proposed increasing the taxes on Social Security benefits for people in higher income brackets. Philip Longman says we need to overhaul the whole Social Security and Medicare system, and it's time to stop being afraid to admit it. Longman is a journalist who wrote the 1987 book Born to Pay. He says there are certain myths that prevent reform. Also today, race, class, and mystery. We meet novelist Barbara Neely. The heroine of her first mystery novel is an African-American maid. And Maureen Carrigan reviews a new collection of letters between the French writers George Sand and Gustave Flaubert. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Clinton administration began the process of selling and explaining its economic proposal to Congress today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
A key player in the administration's sales job is Budget Director Leon Panetta, a former congressman who was widely respected as chairman of the House Budget Committee. Today, Panetta appeared before his old colleagues and found himself facing sometimes hostile questions from Republicans on the panel who say the Clinton plan taxes too much and doesn't cut spending enough.
Your party has to basically confront the fact that if everybody is going to deal with deficit reduction, we mean everybody. We mean the wealthy, we mean businesses, we mean everybody.
Panetta also found himself in the embarrassing position of explaining the administration's arithmetic. Yesterday, the White House said the Clinton proposal would cut almost $500 billion from the deficit over 5 years. Today, Panetta conceded the net reduction would be just $325 billion. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
The nation's biggest aircraft builder announced today that it will trim its workforce by about 20% over the next 2 years. Boeing company chairman Frank Schront said that a weakening commercial aircraft market will force the company to eliminate 22,000 jobs this year and another 5,000 next year. The Seattle-based aircraft maker said that the cuts will include losses of 15,000 jobs in Washington State, 6,000 in Wichita, Kansas, and the rest at other Boeing locations nationwide. Washington State is expected to lose another 4,000 Boeing jobs in the first half of 1994, with another 1,000 lost in Wichita. Analysts had already predicted substantial cuts at Boeing after the company announced that it was cutting production by up to 30% on its four major aircraft types. African National Congress leaders have endorsed a plan for 5 years of multi-party rule in South Africa. A government of national unity, including representatives of the white minority, would take power after the country's first democratic elections, expected by early next year. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
Any party that gets at least 5% of the votes in national elections should be included in South Africa's first post-apartheid cabinet. The plan for a five-year government of national unity is a compromise. It rejects the current government's insistence on a permanent share of power for the white minority, and it disappoints many blacks who want immediate, full-fledged majority rule. More militant leaders within the ANC argued unsuccessfully against the plan adopted today, which is an important step toward elections. But the ANC's proposal still has to be ratified at multi-party talks expected to reconvene next month. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 10 points to close at 3,302. On the broader market, advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. A Haitian soldier has apparently surrendered peacefully after hijacking an American missionary plane in Haiti and ordering it to fly to Miami. The hijacker emerged from the DC-3 plane with his hands over his head and was handcuffed and led away by SWAT team police. The Associated Press quoted a federal law enforcement source as saying that the hijacker had given his gun to the crew during the flight. The plane was carrying 9 passengers and 2 crew members, as well as the hijacker and a woman hostage he had seized on the ground. Another source told AP that everyone but the hijacker was American. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has arrived in Egypt for the start of a Middle East tour. It's his first trip overseas since taking office. From Cairo, Lori Neff reports the secretary is calling on Arabs and Israelis to work harder for peace in the region.
Upon his arrival in Cairo, Secretary Christopher said the U.S. believes there are what he calls important opportunities here that the party should not miss. He says the U.S. has come to the region to do its best and will be assessing whether the parties are ready to do theirs. Earlier, a senior U.S. official told reporters if what he termed stalemated Middle East peace talks can't be restarted, the Clinton administration may turn its attention to other world problems. Peace talks have been stalled since Israel expelled some 400 Palestinians in December. Arabs say Israel's recent offer to take back 100 Palestinians now and the rest by the end of the year isn't enough to get Arab parties to return to the negotiations. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
The State Department charged today that Libya is expanding its capacity to build chemical weapons in violation of the World Treaty banning such weapons. Spokesman Joseph Snyder said the United States and other countries are taking steps to cut off outside supplies to the Libyan program. The announcement came after the New York Times reported today that Libya is building a subterranean chemical weapons plant that's disguised as part of a water project. The UN has imposed a mandatory ban on any weapons-related exports to Libya. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the many controversial parts of President Clinton's economic program involves increasing the taxes on Social Security benefits. This would affect individuals with incomes over $25,000 and couples with incomes over $32,000. My guest, Philip Longman, has been reporting on entitlement programs for about a decade. He thinks President Clinton is taking a few baby steps in the right direction, but what's really needed is a total overhaul of all entitlement programs. Longman says the Social Security system no longer expresses the ideals behind its creation. The system now favors the privileged. And if we continue at the rate we're going, it will be bankrupt in 17 years. Longman is the author of a 1987 book about why the Social Security system is heading toward financial disaster called Born to Pay. He's writing a new book about entitlements. To help get a perspective on Social Security, I asked Longman how much of the federal budget is spent on it.
Well, it depends how you measure it, but it cruises along at about 5% of the gross national product. Total spending on the elderly now accounts for 60% of all social spending. Social Security, of course, has some programs that benefit young people, such as the disability component of Social Security. But it's a major source of government spending. Actually, about three-quarters of the total growth in the deficit results from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and federal pensions. The current proposals that Clinton has out only address the real problems of entitlements at the margins. He has some highly symbolic sacrifices that he asks, but nothing that really puts these programs on a sound footing for the next century.
Now, if I understand your writing correctly, you're not proposing that we do away with Social Security for retirees. You just want to see it reformed so that Social Security is distributed in a more equitable way.
Well, I think we have to make it closer to what it was originally intended to be, which is a social insurance program against the very real possibility that any of us may become poor in old age. Unfortunately, it has over the years evolved into something quite different than that. Currently, Social Security and Medicare together are distributing about $75 billion a year to people who earn more than $50,000 a year. And, of course, it's raising that money largely through or exclusively through a payroll tax on younger workers that hits the poor hardest. Again, even if we didn't need this money for investments in the future, this would simply be an unfair and untenable income redistribution system.
Now, I think most of us think of Social Security like this: during our working years, we put in a certain amount of money. Then, when we retire, we get that money back, and that money sustains us in our retirement years. And it's upsetting to think that the government's going to like change the rules on us, and that when we retire, we're going to make less than what we expected, or less than what we were promised.
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head. I mean, that is the political problem with Social Security, is that most people believe that, and they believe it for a good reason. The Social Security Administration for the last 50 years has been telling people that. So you can't really blame the American people for believing it. But unfortunately, it's convenient as it is to believe it, it's just not true. People retiring today can look forward to, on average, about a $32,000 a year windfall profit. That is, if you take the total amount of contributions that they've made to Social Security on average over their working lives, you adjust it for inflation. And that's very important because a lot of people don't realize this. You adjust it for inflation so that the dollars you're counting today are the same as the dollars you might be counting in 1955 or so. It still comes out that the average retiree today, just in the Social Security program, is getting back about two and a half times what he paid in. Or put another way, he'll get back in the first 10 years of his retirement what he paid in, yet the life tables tell us on average they'll live 20 years. Then, of course, that doesn't even count the really extraordinary rates of return that are available under Medicare, which have been estimated by the government to be on the order of 12 times the benefit being returned to today's recipient in comparison to what they paid into the system.
I don't really understand what the correlation is between the money that you pay in during your working years and the money you get back when you retire.
Well, there is no correlation. It's politically determined. Another very common myth about Social Security is that the government somehow keeps an account or even keeps track of the money that you give to them over the years, and that money sits in a little pot and earns interest, and then when you retire, you make a claim on that. In reality, the money that the government collects from workers each month goes that same month towards one of two purposes nowadays, either to pay for the benefits of current recipients or to help underwrite the national debt. But in neither case is anything being set aside to pay for future benefits, contrary to a lot of myths about there being a surplus in the Social Security system. And so anyway, the system is as they say, a pay-as-you-go system. The money you pay into it is spent as you pay into it. And so when you reach retirement age, it isn't there anymore.
If you worked for a fairly low income throughout your working years, when you retire, will you get significantly less in Social Security than somebody who got a lot of money in their paycheck during their working years?
The program pays the highest benefit to those least in need. In other words, the more money you have, the bigger your benefit. The less money you earned over your lifetime, the less Social Security you'll get. It's another crazy aspect of the system.
I guess there's two different ways to look at what is most equitable. One is that the people who put in the most money to the system should get the most out of it. The other way to look at it is the people who need the money the most should get the most money.
Well, that's right. But I don't really understand why when the system... I mean, you have to take account for the fact that the promises were made, people were told that they were pre-funding their retirement by these kind of contributions, and that obviously is politically important, it's morally important, and nobody's suggesting that Social Security benefits simply be cut. But what we are suggesting is, in the current climate, that perhaps it would be appropriate for people to expect to get no more back from Social Security than they paid in, plus interest. And that would be really to hold them to the standard of social insurance. Remember that if you're going to think of the Social Security system as a insurance system, it's one that's gone amok. It's one that's paying far more in benefits than it collected in contributions. So if we're going to think of it only as a insurance system, it's time to cut benefits across the board dramatically. But, of course, it isn't an insurance system, and that's not the appropriate thing to do.
The Social Security system was started under the Roosevelt administration in 1935. Were there certain New Deal assumptions that you think are no longer true in the 1990s?
Yes. Actually, it's not the assumptions that were made in the 1930s so much as the assumptions that were made in the 1970s and 60s when the Social Security program was dramatically expanded. And those assumptions were that the baby boom that was going on at that time would continue forever, that there would be ever higher birth rates in the United States so that you'd have ever more people paying into the system, and probably more profoundly that the next generation would grow up to be many, many times more affluent than the current generation. You probably remember some of the atmosphere of the early 1970s, but this was a time when economists testified before Congress and seriously estimated that within 20 years, the American workforce would be working an average of 20 hours a week and making four or five times the average wage of workers in 1970. Well, I mean, it would have been nice if it was true, but it didn't happen. Unfortunately, they structured the financing of Social Security and many other entitlements as if it were going to happen. And that is the key policy error that was made that is causing all these problems with our entitlement programs right now. Our kids, there's fewer kids than we thought there were going to be because birth rates have been declining until very recently. And of course, they are not anywhere near as affluent as we might have hoped. The poverty rate now among children is 1 out of 5. Children are now the poorest age group in our society. And it's just nuts to bank the future of the country's finances on the ability of this huge poverty population to grow up to be richer than we are, despite all the handicaps we're placing in their way.
At what point does the United States start to change demographically in a way significant enough to really change the Social Security system, the ability of the Social Security system to support itself?
Well, the really tough years start in 2010, because that's when the baby boom generation starts moving into old age in a big way. And immediately the system begins running huge deficits. The amount of payroll taxes needed to cover Social Security escalate dramatically. So those are the tough years. I mean, one of the really scary things about right now is that demographically, this should be the best of times for the United States. Right now, we have what might be called the middle aging of America going on. That is, the fastest growing age group in America now is the cohorts in their 40s and 50s. That's because of the aging of the baby boom generation into that time of life. And those are the years when people typically earn their highest salaries and pay the most in taxes and are the most productive. So right now, you couldn't ask for the country's demographics to be any more favorable, and yet look at these huge deficits. That gives you some kind of hint of what's coming in the next century when all these trends are thrown into reverse.
So you think unless we reform the Social Security system that there's no way it's going to be able to support itself?
No, not without imposing impossible burdens on the next generation. I mean, it's always theoretically possible to raise payroll taxes up to the 50% of payroll that the Social Security Administration projects will ultimately be needed. But I think in the real world, our kids won't stand for that. They'll tell us where to go. I think we've been talking a lot about Social Security, but in many ways, health care is even a deeper problem. Right now, we're not spending as much on Medicare as we are on Social Security, but because of the just really dramatic trends in the cost of health care that are, of course, driven by the aging of the population, it really, and if you take a not-so-long view into the future, it's health care that is the thing that we really ought to be concentrating on.
My guest is journalist Philip Longman, author of the 1987 book Born to Pay and a forthcoming book about entitlements. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Philip Longman is my guest. Well, Hillary Clinton is looking into reforming the whole healthcare system. What are some of the problems you see that you think really need to be addressed?
Well, again, we have to analyze what is causing the problem. And the two big trends are working in concert to cause this incredible escalation in healthcare costs. One is the aging of the population. As we get older, we all need more health care, so an aging population has a greater demand for health care, dramatically greater demand. The other is this relentless increase in the utilization of high technology, much of which has very dubious actual medical benefits, but which is nonetheless very, very expensive. And right now we just have no way to put a brake on that, and we don't budget for healthcare. We don't sit down and figure out our priorities as far as what kind of healthcare we want and how we want it delivered and when in our lives we want it delivered.
Let me stop you there. The when in our lives we want it delivered, what's the issue there?
Well, right now we have a system of publicly financed healthcare that provides almost all of its benefits to people at the end of their lives. And very little, if any, benefit to people at the beginning of their lives. And this is creates a perverse world, because here, after all, it's as if before you were born, God or whoever was in charge came to you and said, well, there's a certain amount of health care we're going to allocate to you over your lifetime. Now, we want you to decide before you're born, when do you want it? Do you want it when you're young, when you're old, when you're in the middle? You know, you tell us. And I think most of us, if we were in that situation, would say, well, the thing I want is that I want to maximize my my chances of getting to be old. That's what amounts to me. And once I have achieved a ripe old age, then I'm increasingly less interested in spending resources that only improve my life expectancy for a matter of days or weeks. And unfortunately, the system we now have really is in essence a system like that. A third of the Medicare dollars that we spend in this country, which of course go exclusively to the population over 65, a third of those dollars go to people who die within a year. And as we all know, or most of us know from personal experience with dying relatives, that there's an enormous amount of money that's spent in the last several days of people's lives, very typically, and in ways that are just impossible to control. And it's that aspect of our healthcare spending that we have to tackle. And it's very tough, and it forces our politics to confront all kinds of choices and issues that we're not accustomed to dealing with in a public forum. But it has to be done, because this is what's driving the cost of healthcare so much, and especially will be driving it in the next century, as we have this explosion in the population over 65.
Do you find that it's very difficult to talk about Medicare reform or Social Security reform without sounding like you're attacking the elderly or, you know, resenting the elderly?
Well, I do find it difficult, and I hope I haven't sounded that way. Sometimes we use shorthand for describing certain classes of people. I don't see this as essentially an issue between the old and the young. I see it as essentially as an issue of how we allocate resources to ourselves over our lifetimes. And I apologize to anybody if I have sounded as if I were attempting to blame the problems of the world on today's senior citizens, because I am not at all. In fact, it's my generation that is causing most of this problem in the long run.
How so?
Well, we're the ones that are the boom. We are the population bulge that is going to swell the ranks of the elderly in the next century. And it's on us to minimize the burden that we're going to present to the few children that are behind us. But we can't. The problem is, the political problem right now is that you can't bring up the subject of Social Security reform or Medicare reform or health care reform in the long run without immediately bumping into the American Association of Retired Persons and the current gray lobby, and getting into a big argument with them about current benefits and who won World War II and all the rest of this stuff. And I would very much like to avoid that argument and raise this whole discussion to a higher plane. But unfortunately, at least for the time that I've been working this issue, which is about 10 years now, there's been a kind of gag rule out there that you do not question the long-term future of Social Security. If you do, you're immediately stereotyped as some kind of right-wing cretin. And I think all this is changing very rapidly now. I think thoughtful people around Clinton and in social policy circles in general now understand these issues a lot better than they did 10 years ago, and the climate of opinion is changing rapidly. But it's still very dangerous and very difficult to talk about these subjects without, as you say, sounding like a granny basher.
Well, I think what you're trying to encourage us to do is to view entitlements as a whole, and instead of chipping away at this part of Social Security and changing the tax on that part, to just kind of rethink the whole thing?
Yes, rethink our entire social welfare state and to kind of come up with reasons or criteria for how we allocate resources. Do we allocate resources merely on the basis of one's birthday, or do we allocate resources on the basis of some kind of need, medical, financial, otherwise? And unfortunately, during the age of the New Deal, you know, America was coming out of a kind of a frontier society, and people had a very individualistic ethics was still dominant, and it was very hard for people to accept benefits from the government in those days. There was a great stigma attached to it, and they saw it as relief. And so huge myths were built up by social policy activists to try and ease the indignity of receiving social benefits for people. And this is what explains the jargon that surrounds Social Security, the jargon of taxes being contributions and all the insurance parlance. But it may have served a purpose in its day, but today it's just getting in the way. I mean, today we need to strip past all the rhetoric and just look at the real peas under the shells and see where is the money actually going, who's benefiting, and does it make any sense? And to try and do that in as value-neutral way as we can.
I know that you think that Social Security is inequitably distributed, that people who have a lot of money end up getting more money than those who really need the money. Do you have any statistics handy about how the money, for instance, was distributed in 1992? Who got what?
Who got what? Let's see. For Social Security program in itself, spent $55 billion last year conveying benefits to families that had income over $50,000 a year. Now, just to put that in perspective, if we took $10 billion and applied it specifically to the problem of eliminating totally poverty among the elderly, $10 billion would do it. If you took $10 billion and targeted it at the remaining elderly population that is poor, that would be enough to lift every one of them above the poverty line. And yet we spent five times that much money, $55 billion, paying Social Security benefits to people who typically use them for paying for their green fees and traveling to tropical ports of call and tooting around the country in an RV with a bumper sticker that says we're outspending our children's inheritance. There's just no reason to be spending that kind of money on people that don't need it, not in the current context.
Are you very worried about your future, by the way? What will happen to you when you retire?
Well, yes, and I wish that the government would put people on notice that they need to be saving a lot more for their retirement than most people are. Most people should be putting away at least 10% of their income towards retirement, and they're not, and they're being lulled into a sense of false confidence by the gag rule that prohibits public discussion of the long-term prospects for Social Security. So, yeah, I'm worried, and so should the rest of you.
Well, thanks for talking with us.
Okay.
Philip Longman is the politics and public policy editor of Florida Trend magazine and the author of the 1987 book on the Social Security system, Born to Pay. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The heroine of the new mystery novel, Blanche on the Lam, is a middle-aged African-American maid. The book's been described as less about a mysterious murder than it is about social injustice, race relations, and the unique position African-American women hold in our society. Coming up, Barbara Neely tells us why she created Blanche. And Maureen Corrigan reviews a new collection of letters between the French writers George Sand and Gustave Flaubert. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has taken his economic plan on the road, stopping first in St. Louis. He presented his proposals in general terms, playing down its impact on middle-income Americans. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold has more on the story.
President Clinton gave a Reader's Digest version of last night's speech to people in a shopping mall in St. Louis today. The event had all the trappings of a campaign, but this campaign was for his economic package, which he knows faces a tough road in Congress. President Clinton was more defensive about his plan today after getting mixed reviews in Congress last night. He challenged those who are calling for more cuts in government spending to specify exactly where.
We need you to tell your members of Congress that we will support you if you make the honest, tough, hard decisions. We know we didn't get into this mess overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight.
While he was out on the road, the president suffered his first defeat in the Senate, where members passed an amendment to block the administration from lifting a ban that prevents AIDS-infected aliens from entering the United States. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in St. Louis.
The Department of Health and Human Services has outlined how the president plans to carry out last night's promise to put the brakes on Medicare, the government program that subsidizes health care for older Americans. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
If the president's budget is adopted by Congress, hospitals and doctors will get less money than they expected for providing Medicare services in the coming years. The government would pay hospitals less for administrative costs, for facilities, and for training young physicians. Doctors themselves won't be paid as much as they were promised in previous budgets. But the government will pay primary care doctors more as a way of encouraging basic preventive care. And in a few years, Medicare patients will have to pay about $15 more a month. Whether these plans are enacted remains to be seen. A health care reform bill could change the whole way care for everyone, including the elderly, is funded. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher, now on a trip to the Middle East, has called on Arabs and Israelis to renew their stalled Middle Eastern peace talks. Christopher said on arriving today in Cairo that there are important opportunities that should not be missed. One U.S. official said that Christopher will see during his visit if there is a serious endeavor underway by all parties, and then report back to President Clinton. The same U.S. official is quoted as saying that the Arab-Israeli dispute cannot continue to have a high priority unless all parties involved are ready to do their part. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 10 points to close at 3302.19 on volume of more than 309 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of nearly 5-4. This is NPR News. According to military officials, the U.S. will start pulling 3,000 more troops out of Somalia next week. This means that 2 weeks from now, there will be 15,000 U.S. troops in the country, a drop of some 10,000 from nearly a month ago. In all, there are 33,000 troops from Western nations in Somalia. They were sent there during U.N. direction to make sure that food supplies get to those who need it. It's hoped that by April, the U.N. will take command of the operation. In Bosnia, Serbian forces are said to have agreed to allow a UN relief convoy to travel in the eastern part of the nation after holding up the mission for 2 days. The commander of UN forces in the country held on-the-spot talks in an effort to get through. Jane Howard reports for the BBC.
UNHCR officials said that Bosnian Serb commanders had pledged to allow one convoy held up on its way to Gorazde to pass tomorrow. They said the militiamen had checked and rechecked the contents of the trucks, which they said was a good sign. The decision came as General Morillon held negotiations on the spot with local commanders. The convoy is made up of unperforated trucks carrying UNHCR food. It's highlighted the confusion about who should have the final say in relief operations, the aid workers or the military who provide the armed escort. UNHCR's official position is to wish the general luck, but privately, they and other UN officials regard General Morillon as a loose cannon who could undermine their efforts. For their part, UN officers feel they were not consulted or properly informed about the decision to suspend relief operations.
Jane Howard in Belgrade. An airplane hijacking has ended at Miami's International Airport. Officials say the DC-3 was taken over by a Haitian soldier in northern Haiti in order to fly to Miami. On board the plane were 9 passengers and 2 crew members, and the hijacker boarded with a hostage. The plane is owned by a missionary group. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Blanche on the Lam is a murder mystery, but the larger mystery facing the heroine is how she can make a living, support her kids, and get the respect she deserves. Blanche is an African-American woman reluctantly working as a live-in maid. Blanche on the Lam is the first book by my guest, Barbara Neely. It just came out in paperback. Before she tells us why she created Blanche, let's hear a reading from the book. I'll let Barbara Neely set the scene.
In this scene, Blanche comes upon her employer, obviously in a state of distress over another member of the household. And she's trying to get some sense of what is happening without getting involved. She's not violent, is she, ma'am? Oh, no, nothing like that. She covered her face and sobbed softly for a few minutes. Finally, she raised her head and looked at Blanche. Blanche was unimpressed by the tears and Grace's Mammy Save Me eyes. Mammy Savers regularly peeped out at her from the faces of some white women for whom she worked, and lately, in this age of the touchy-feely model of manhood, an occasional white man. It happened when an employer was struck by family disaster or grew too compulsive about owning everything, too overwrought or downright frightened by who and what they were. She never ceased to be amazed at how many white people longed for Aunt Jemima. They'd ease into the kitchen and hem and haw their way through some sordid personal tale. She'd listen and make sympathetic noises. She rarely asked questions, except to clarify the life lessons their stories conveyed, or to elicit some detail that would make their story more amusing to her friends. She told employers who asked what she would do in their place or what she thought they ought to do. "I sure wish I knew, I truly do," accompanied by a slow, sad smile, a matching shake of her head and arms folded tightly across her chest. Now Blanche knew that if she went to Grace, put her hand on the woman's shoulder and looked concerned, it was likely Grace would bear the family soul. But Blanche didn't yet know whether Grace was the kind of person who both longed for someone on whom to unburden herself and was then grateful to the listener, or the kind of person who resented the listener for catching her at a weak moment. She took a half step forward, hesitated, then crossed the room to where Grace sat. "Is there anything I can do for you, ma'am?" Whether she cared or not, there were certain expected forms to be observed.
Barbara Neely, why did you create a domestic worker as your main character for your fiction?
Well, you know, I really wanted to write about race, class, and gender in America in a way that wouldn't frighten people to death and would be both amusing and informative. And a domestic worker seemed the perfect vehicle for doing that.
Why?
Well, here is a person who, according to the larger society, has no worldview, no inner life, no story to tell, who in fact has a great deal to say about the world in which we live because she is, in most instances, an observer who gets to see it all, comment on it internally, but is essentially invisible to the rest of the society.
Now, there are a lot of places, like in the passage you just read, where Blanche has to always guess what the white employers want from her, and then she has to guess how they'll react if she delivers on that. Do you think that that's true of a lot of relations between African Americans and white people in general, or do you think that that kind of guessing is more specific to this, you know, black domestic worker, white wealthy employer relationship?
Certainly, I think the relationship that an African-American person is having with a white person dictates how much guessing has to go on our part. But you know, Terry, we have always said ever since we've been in this country that we know white folks better than they know us because we have essentially been invisible in the society. And we are used to having to do that kind of second guessing. I mean, historically, people ended up hanging from trees because they didn't make the right assumption about what it was that white folks wanted. So I think it's fairly common for us to both do that and be able to do it. But even in a larger sense, I think that this is very much a sort of class-bound relationship, and that you will find that white folks who are part of the service industry, for example, have very many of the same attitudes that Blanche has towards their employers. Folks who've come to readings have talked about the fact, especially white folks. I remember a man in Philadelphia who was a truck driver, a white truck driver, talked about the fact that he appreciated Blanche's invisibility because it was something that he himself suffered from, that the folks to whose houses he delivered expensive goods rarely saw him as anything other than a part of a moving machine. So I do think it's as much class-bound as it is race-bound.
Now, I want to get back to the passage that you just read in which Blanche is thinking about how white employers always want to unburden themselves to the black hired help, and she's trying to figure out how to handle this. How did you know about that?
Well, I had two grandmothers who did domestic work, and they had many friends, of course, who did domestic work. I remember hearing them talk as a child about how they were expected to do for their employers what they generally paid their psychiatrists and therapists hundreds of dollars for doing, and that is listening to their problems and coming up with some sort of solution to them. The women that I know who did domestic work talked about that a great deal and laughed about it a lot as well.
The relationship that the maid has with the babies she has to take care of and the elderly and infirm who she has to care for. Blanche understands how you can love some of the people who you care for, but she thinks you'd be a fool to think that they really love you.
Because the proof is in the pudding, ultimately. I mean, you know the people who love you by the way they treat you. And if they do not pay you a decent wage and they don't give you a decent vacation, then what is the definition of love? I mean, certainly they love their families and they don't treat them the way they treat the domestic help. So this is something that Blanche and I think lots of domestic workers and lots of service workers, you know, really understand, that there is this sort of mythology about who they are and how they operate and how they love that has really been developed, I think, to protect employers from the knowledge of how they're exploiting folks.
My guest is Barbara Neely. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Barbara Neely, author of the mystery novel Blanche on the Lam. The character that you've created, Blanche, is, as you've once said, someone who probably wouldn't describe herself as a feminist but behaves like one.
Oh, yes.
Why did you want her to behave like one but not identify as one?
Well, because I think that makes her very much a woman of the moment, in the sense that I believe that there are lots of poor and working class women out there who, in fact, are the people who push feminism on the job and in the community, but who have never read feminist theory, probably would want you to define exactly what it is that you mean by feminist, but at the same time are very, very concerned about their equality in the workplace, certainly know that they are equal to any man out there in the world. And so for me, are actually the sort of behavioral feminists. You know, there are the feminists who are working on the theory, and then there are the feminists on the front line. And I think that Blanche and women like her are, in fact, the feminists on the front line. She's very much like the women that I grew up with, who as far as I know, never identified themselves as feminist, but, you know, try to treat them like second-class citizens and see what happens to you.
Where do you place yourself?
Oh, there's no question in my mind. I am a staunch, hard-line, hard-fried feminist. Always have been and expect always to be.
Your character, Blanche, says it was hard for her to become her own woman and get out from her mother's strong hand. Did you have a very strong mother?
All the women in my family are extremely strong, and I think that all of us have to arm wrestle to get our freedom, probably because our mothers are so aware of all of the horrendous stuff that waits for you out there as a young African-American woman. And they hold on to us because they care about us. But it isn't done in a way that sort of makes you feel as though your life is always going to be truncated. You just start about the age of 17 thinking about what you're going to do when you leave home. But I was very grateful for that. I think that I was very lucky to grow up with the women with whom I did grow up. I had many mothers, as you often do in an extended family, both my mother's girlfriends and cousins and aunts and other folks. And I think it's kind of life that lots of people could benefit from.
Now, your character Blanche never wanted to be a mother, but her sister died of cancer and left Blanche with her two children. Why did you create that kind of arrangement in your novel? A woman who didn't want to be a mother, who isn't married, but ends up with two children who she at first resents having to take care of, but really grows to love very, very deeply.
I think this is a very real situation in communities of color and other poor communities where folks take on the responsibility of taking care of children who are orphaned in the family. My reason for doing it this way really was that I don't have any children, and I wasn't really comfortable writing about Blanche as a mother. At the same time, it seemed very artificial to me for her not to have children, since that is so rare in our community to find women who are childless, especially childless by choice. And I knew that children had to be in there somewhere, so this seemed to be a situation that I could handle, since I do have a niece and nephew that I'm absolutely mad about.
So how come you decided to not have children? That might be too personal, so you could just let me know.
I don't really mind answering it. You know, I've been feeling more and more, it seems to me that women who have chosen not to have children are slightly besieged these days. And so it feels important for me to sort of stick up for us. I decided not to have children because I didn't think that I would be willing to put the kind of energy and time into raising a child that I think it takes. I think that it was easier for me to make that decision knowing that there would be children in my life. That is, that my sister has a child or now has two children, that my cousins have children, that I would be a part of children's lives and they would be a part of my life. But I didn't want to do a half good job at it.
Blanche on the Lam is your first book.
Mm-hmm.
You're in your early 50s now. Did you start writing later in life?
I did. I didn't start writing until I was in my late 30s, actually. It took me a long time, I think partly to decide that I had something to say. I've always been encouraged to write, you know, through school and university, but I never saw it as a viable way of making a living. It was always something that, you know, you did if you had time and you did for fun. But I got to a point in my life where I actually had to do it. I mean, the writing was something that became so important to me that I didn't think I would be able to function unless I began to take myself seriously as a writer.
Oh, what was happening to you? What were the symptoms?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened, and I think the thing that really moved me to do this, as I said, I've been writing off and on all of my life some poetry that if anybody ever sees any of it, I am going to swear was written by somebody with the same name, but not me. And, you know, short stories for friends for birthdays and that sort of thing. And thinking more and more as I got older that I really did want to write, but not being necessarily prepared to take the risk. I was in San Francisco and walking down Market Street at Powell, where the streetcar turns around. There was a San Francisco street band playing, An old black woman came up and started dancing in front of the band. And there were lots of folks standing around laughing, and certainly laughing at her. But she began to dance in a way that sort of silenced the crowd. That is, she would make eye contact with sort of random people in the crowd and point her finger at them and look at them in a very serious way. And I swear, Terry, when this woman looked at me, I could hear her say, "Darling, if you want to dance, you better do it today." I went back to my room at the San Francisco Residence Club and began writing that woman's story, which I never finished. I have about three boxes of notes in my basement. But it was at that point that I began to write seriously. And as I said, that was, late 70s. And I think my first short story was published in 80 or 81.
Strange how what we project onto a stranger can have such a profound impact.
Absolutely. You know, clearly it was time for me to do that,
yeah,
whether
right.
this woman showed up or not.
Because she didn't really say a word to you,
no,
right?
She didn't say a word to me. But, you know, she clearly triggered something in me. And I think that part of that was the fact that I was a woman in my 30s. And if I wasn't going to do it then, when was I going to do it?
It's almost like you needed to project onto like some older woman the permission that you needed to take yourself seriously.
Well, you know, now that you mention it, that probably is true. And it sort of fits with my whole life, because there have always been in my family older women who I have turned to say yes or no. I think this is a good idea, or I think this is a bad idea. I didn't necessarily listen to them, unfortunately. But I do expect to turn to older women for advice.
Barbara Neely, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it.
Barbara Neely's novel Blanche on the Lam just came out in paperback. A second Blanche novel is in the works. This is Fresh Air. Today, everybody has been evaluating President Clinton's economic proposals. Let's see what kind of response we can expect on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, what kind of reaction are you getting?
Well, we'll be hearing a lot of favorable reaction from Democrats and critical from Republicans.
What a
and,
shock.
We'll also be hearing from reporter Eric Weiner about how the plan, as it has been proposed by the president, would likely affect an average middle-class family. We'll also have a report from Patricia Naimond today about managed competition. That's one of the ideas that's governing the Clinton administration's proposed health care reform, or the health care reform that's in the works, how it would work, what it would do to maintain quality, and in what ways it might limit choice.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you saw the movie Impromptu, you know that the French author George Sand wrote her novels in the dead of the night, preferred pants to dresses, and made beautiful music with the composer Frédéric Chopin. During the final 10 years of her life, Sand was involved with another timid man of genius, Gustave Flaubert. Theirs was not a romantic affair, but a deep friendship conducted mainly through the mail. The first English edition of their correspondence has just been published, and critic Maureen Carrigan says nobody writes letters like this anymore.
I know that people were different in the 19th century, but I don't think I ever realized how different until I read this passage from George Sand's diary, dated May 25th, 1868. Flaubert and I went upstairs at 9 o'clock. Flaubert read me 300 excellent pages of The Sentimental Education, which I think delightful. I went to bed at 2. 300 pages? Remember last month when Maya Angelou read her poem at the inauguration and some people complained that it was too long, like they wanted an inauguration haiku? Well, by my estimate, Angelou's poem clocked in at 8 minutes. It probably took Flaubert that long just to clear his throat. And he may have hogged the floor during these marathon readings, but when it came to letter writing, Flaubert and George Sand were on equal footing. Between 1863, when Flaubert first wrote to Sand, and 1876, the year Sand died, the pair exchanged over 400 letters. When the correspondence began, Sand was 59 years old. She was revered for her novels, plays, and memoirs, as well as for her liberal politics and legendary love affairs. Flaubert, who was 42 and a recluse, was Sand's bizarro world double. He was never that popular with the public, who often found his novels misanthropic and obscene. And unlike Sand, Flaubert was a slow writer. In an 1867 letter to her, he moans, "Every day I chip away at my coconut, like a convict breaking stones. I'm one myself, not a convict, a nut." Personality differences like these make for great Tracy Hepburn movies, but they usually doom relationships. The Flaubert-Sand chemistry worked because they weren't in competition and because they rarely saw one another. As the years passed, Flaubert concocted increasingly frantic excuses to avoid visiting Sand. He's immobilized by the summer heat, by lusty hotel neighbors who disrupt his sleep, by a huge boil on his face, and by the flatness of his purse. Sand, who celebrated her 70th birthday with a brisk dip in an icy mountain stream, accepted her friend's excuses with a Gallic shrug. The appeal of letters like these is similar to the come-on of celebrity autobiographies, namely, that we'll get to know the real people inside the public personalities. But just like the autobiographical character of, say, a Norman Schwarzkopf has been shaped to fit readers' pre-existing images, the Flaubert and Sand we meet here are partly fictional creations. They consciously try to live up to their own reputations and to satisfy each other's desires in a pen pal. Sand often deliberately seems to play happy to Flaubert's grumpy, and yet glimpses of the private Sand and Flaubert do emerge, especially when tragic events like war disrupt their familiar roles as letter writers. The Flaubert-Sand correspondence overflows with gossip, passionate arguments about art, and above all, a poetry that neither writer could suppress, even in describing the most mundane events. For me, Flaubert's occasional greeting to Sand, "So, let's chat," ranks right up there with "Once Upon a Time" as one of the most tantalizing openings in literature.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Flaubert-Sand, The Correspondence. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet artist Andre Serrano. His photograph of a crucifix immersed in urine was one of the artworks that provoked Jesse Helms' crusade against federal funding of controversial art. Serrano's latest gallery show features photographs of the dead taken at a morgue. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.